Can you tell me about your good friend, A.R. Gurney?
How would you like me to start?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. Thanks for subscribing, streaming, or downloading and listening to us on your computer or tablet or phone. I'm Austin Titchener, one third of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, number 549, Remembering A.R. Gurney. A.R. Gurney, the celebrated playwright and so-called, quote, chronicler of contemporary America's most unfashionable social stratum, upper middle-class WASPs, according to Frank Rich of the New York Times, died this week at the age of 86. Pete, as he was known to one and all, wrote Love Letters, The Dining Room, over 40 plays in all, and our friend Howard Sherman was a very good friend of his. Regular podcast listeners will remember Howard, the bon vivant and raconteur, theater advocate, and currently both the director of the Arts Integrity Initiative at the New School of Drama in New York City and the U.S. columnist for The Stage newspaper in London. Howard began his reminiscences by talking about the plays of A.R. Gurney.
While Pete was raised in that WASP society, growing up in the, you know, in the 40s, you know, and into the 50s in Buffalo, New York, if you look at his plays aren't love letters to a bygone era. They are all increasingly, as he got older, looks at how that society was in decline, even reaching the point in an interview that he did that I did with him 2 years ago for American Theatre Magazine, where he essentially said it's now dead.
Yeah.
But it wasn't about depicting Pleasantville, you know, to reference that movie where everything was glorious and wasn't this a wonderful way. This was a guy brought up in a very particular culture and spent his whole career needling that culture, not so rigorously that it would turn people off, but neither treating it with the idea that it was something to be preserved and that we're losing. And that's why with a play like The Cocktail Hour, he literally couldn't do that play until his father had passed away, because his father would have been furious. Yeah. His family was not keen on the life that he chose, and they were not keen about his messaging. And while many of the families that he portrayed over the years would be considered conservative Republican families, even if those words weren't necessarily used, Pete was a liberal Democrat. And again, Pete never got on the soapbox politically, but you really need to look at his plays and see what they're actually saying, not just the characters that appear in them.
Yeah, he was a chronicler of a culture, warts and all. I'm not as familiar with his work as I probably should be, but I know The Cocktail Hour and The Dining Room and Love Letters and it's I go back to his theatricality. The Dining Room is such a lovely theatrical idea in which to depict a whole different series of colors of a certain world.
Right. And there's an earlier work by Pete from about 1971 called Scenes from American Life, which uses the same kind of structure. He was not, for the most part, an experimenter in structure. Most of his plays, I would say, were relatively straightforward in terms of being linear, taking place in a single set, with everybody playing one character. Dining Room was certainly more inventive in the way that it used six actors to play an entire range of people over a range of ages, without ever specifying exactly who they were, or, you know, were they even the same family from scene to scene. And I think that's where, you know, it's certainly where he really made his mark. And what's also extraordinary is that that breakthrough play came when he was about 50 years old. Mm. You know, people our age, it seems like there's just been this mass of Pete Gurney plays forever. And while he'd been writing, and when Dining Room hit, there were several earlier plays that were then revived in the way that now a young playwright, if they've written four or five plays and they have a hit, suddenly those other plays immediately get on somewhere else. Yes, there was a bit of a backlog, but they hadn't been hits. Some of them had run for a single night. The other extraordinary thing about Pete in terms of his recognition is the fact that in his entire career, he only had four plays go to Broadway and none of them were ever really hits. Mm. He was very much a byproduct, or his success was very much a byproduct of off-Broadway theater and the regional theater. And in recent years, even though his work would get done off Broadway and you'd see a 6 or 8 week run of a show, it's not like it was in the 80s and the 90s when then they would transfer to a commercial run and run for a year. More recently, they would get on, they'd get done, and then they'd fan out to the regionals.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it's interesting too, because with our increasing, thankfully, diversity in theater, again, his plays are filled with people that, like, I just read Love Letters, did the full production of Love Letters at Pacific University in Oregon, meaning that another old friend and I sat and read the play in front of people, which is how that is, that play is meant to be produced. And for these kids in Oregon, they don't know anything about this rarefied world of Northeast boarding schools and Upper East Side Manhattan life. And yet, by the end of it, you did get such a wonderful sense of these lives, both the highs and the lows, and the pains and the glories. It's really lovely. And as an actor who had to play the man in that thing, it says Pete's directions were, please don't cry at the end. But
right.
The man has this long speech at the end, which I defy an actor to not cry at the end.
Well,
it's lovely.
And it is actually an interesting structural idea in that it is a play that is not meant to be performed except seated and reading, and it is utterly realistic and utterly linear until its very last moment, when it takes just a slight turn into, is it fantasy, is it wish fulfillment, what is it? And it's quite beautiful and can be performed by people of any age, mm-hmm. can be performed by people of any ethnicity. It works. I've seen it. I probably saw it about 4 or 5 times. And the last time I saw it, and this is now well over 20 years ago, was a special Mother's Day performance at the Long Wharf Theater. And the actors were Jessica Tandy and Hume Cronin.
Wow.
And at the end, when she turns to him, and I'm not giving away any secrets, and says, you have been my best friend for my whole life. Okay. And it's Jessica Tandy saying this to Hume Cronin. I don't care what Pete's stage directions were. Try to tell an audience not to respond to that. And it ended, and Pete was there, and I saw him after, and I turned to him and I said, I'm never going to go see this again, because it can't ever be better than this. And he said, yeah, that makes sense. That's okay.
Hi, this is Ellen Margolis, Chair of Theater and Dance at Pacific University in Oregon, and you're listening to the Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast.
Where can you RSC the RSC? In August, you'll be able to see James Percy, Matt Pearson, and Joe Maudsley perform William Shakespeare's long-lost first play Abridged at the Gilded Balloon in Edinburgh. This fall, starting in September, you can see us perform All the Great Books Abridged, William Shakespeare's long-lost first play Abridged, and The Ultimate Christmas Show Abridged across the U.S. in Culver and South Bend, Indiana, West Long Branch, New Jersey, Aiken, South Carolina, Davis, California, Laramie, Wyoming, these days have just been added, Asheville, North Carolina, Maryville, Tennessee, Somerville, New Jersey, Algona, Iowa, and Reston, Virginia. And also this September, you can see us perform the complete works of William Shakespeare Abridged, Revised, in Hong Kong and Singapore. Next winter, we'll also be performing William Shakespeare's long-lost first play Abridged off-Broadway at the New Victory Theater in New York City. And a year from now, in 2018, we'll return to the Pittsburgh Public Theater to close out their season with our production of William Shakespeare's long-lost first play Abridged. As always, the very best way to stay up to date about all of our worldwide performance dates is to sign up for the Reduced Reader, our email newsletter. Go to ReducedShakespeare.com and click on the link to subscribe and check out our touring page for specific box office venue and ticket information. Now back to my conversation with Howard Sherman about his good friend and mentor, playwright A.R. Gurney, except that Howard is just about to correct me about that description.
Well, I can't call him a mentor because I'm not a playwright. He was, and you know, you could talk to, I think, anyone who knew him, and they would tell you he was a gentleman in the very best sense of what that meant. He was warm and caring and interested in who you were and what you did. And I met him about 2 weeks after I graduated college, 33 years ago, because I was doing, I was working in the summer at the Westport Country Playhouse, which in that period was doing a Gurney play every summer. And there was a, first there was just a press event where everybody involved in the season came, and that was the first time I met him. And a few weeks later, I was rounding up interviews for him to do. And, you know, he was absolutely lovely. And then flash forward 2 years later, and I'm at Hartford Stage, and we were doing a production of his play Children, probably one of his lesser known plays. And he wasn't involved in the production. It was a play from years earlier. But because I knew him from Westport, I called him up. I knew he lived in Connecticut part of the time. And I said, would you be willing to come and do publicity for us? And he said, okay, and said, I'll be driving from Connecticut to MIT, where he taught, and I'll just stop off in Hartford for a few hours, and I'll do whatever you want. And then a couple of years later, we did the premiere of his play, The Snowball, the largest, most physically complicated play he ever wrote. And then just by being in Connecticut, being around theater, I would see him, you know, at openings, in lobbies. I remember literally when I saw Lion King, he was at the same performance and he was coming up the aisle and we ran into each other and he looked and he said, it's pretty good, isn't it? Like, you know, Lion King, when it was brand new, that was, it's like, I did say to him, I said, I think that's an understatement, Pete.
Yeah.
you know, and just, every time I saw him, he was the same warm and interested and thoughtful guy. And certainly one moment, and then I'll backtrack for a minute, that I'll never forget. When I went to work at the American Theater Wing, and it wasn't like I suddenly sent out press releases and notified everybody I knew, and it was pre-social media, and I don't recall that Pete was ever on social media. But I got a call within the first week I was there, and it was Pete who'd heard I'd gotten the job, and he wanted to tell me he was proud of me. Uh-huh. And that's the nature of how he looked on me. He was somebody who, at that point, he'd known for about 20 years, and he'd known me since I was, you know, a college graduate, and he just wanted to let me know that he knew of what I was doing and he thought it was great. And that was incredibly sweet. Though I did discover, because I interviewed him so many times, he kept telling me for probably the last 10 years that he kept saying he was thinking about giving it up, and he never did. He kept talking about retiring, and he never retired. You know, he was and became even more prolific as he got older, because he found between Lincoln Center Theater and the Westport Country Playhouse and the Flea Theater in downtown New York, that there were places that were actually hungry for his plays. So and at the Flea, where he did some of his most political work, he became, in the latter half of his 70s and the first half of his 80s, you know, a hot, young, off Broadway playwright starting at age 75. The great story that I love to tell about Pete also relates to another playwright that I'm close to, Alan Ayckbourn. And as I'd like to point out, you know, being friends with two of the most prolific playwrights writing in the English language is a challenge, because Pete, I think, wrote over 40 plays, and Alan has passed 80 at this time. I was in Scarborough, England, seeing Alan and his wife, and seeing Alan's new plays. And this was 1999. And Alan mentioned that at that moment he was in rehearsal with a play of Pete's. He was directing it for his company, the Stephen Joseph Theater. And I said, "Oh my gosh, I know Pete. Do you know him?" And Alan said, "No, I admire his work very much, and I've directed a couple of his plays. And we know some people in common, but we've never connected." And I said, "Gee, that's really a shame." And you know, he said, "Well, whenever you see him next, please tell him I think very highly of him." And I got back, and about 3 weeks later, I was up at Glimmerglass Opera, where I was seeing a program of 3 one-act operas, one of which Pete had done the libretto for. And sure enough, immediately after the first opera, Pete comes up the aisle. All of my stories about Pete Gurney are about Pete coming up the aisle, practically. Pete comes up the aisle, and I said, "I have regards for you from an admirer." And he says, "Oh, who's that?" And I said, "Alan Ayckbourn." And he really sort of gasped and said, "Alan Ayckbourn's an admirer of mine?" I said, "Very much so." He said, "Alan Ayckbourn's brilliant. When I was teaching, I always included in an Ayckbourn play for the students to really understand how comedy should be written." And I said, well, get this. He's directing, I think it was Later Life, you know, but we'll say it is for this version. You know, he's directing a production of Later Life right now. And Pete was like, "Alan Ayckbourn's directing one of my plays?" And I said, "You know what, Pete? Clearly the two of you should meet, and I will make it my mission that the next time Alan is in the U.S., I will make it possible for the two of you to sit down and have a meal together." And 2 years later, when By Jeeves was coming to Broadway, I arranged that dinner. And it was Pete and his wife, Molly, and Alan and his wife, Heather. And I was at the O'Neill Center at the time, Tom Vertel, who's the chairman of the board there, and his partner, Pat Daly, and me. And of course, the joy for Tom and Pat and me, as we talked about often afterwards, was just, we just got to sit there and watch these guys who we so admired just get to know one another. And my favorite moment in the whole meal, at one point there was a bit of a lull, and Alan turned to Pete and said, "So, what number are you on?" And without missing a beat, not even questioning, Pete said, at that point, I think, you know, he said, I'm in the 30s. I'm not even close to where you are." And I likened it to, there was no pretense. They weren't discussing art. They weren't discussing theory. They weren't discussing anything. These guys could have been two guys who were bricklayers, and they just were discussing how many walls they built. And it was the most matter-of-fact thing in the world. And it was an extraordinary moment.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast. Send us your chronicle of a rarefied culture via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com. You can also engage with us and other fans on Facebook or Twitter. You can find easy links to all these social networks at our website, reducedshakespeare.com. You can also follow me on Twitter @AustinTichner. You can also follow Howard on Twitter @HESherman. And the RSC is now on Instagram, too, at Reduced Shakespeare Company. Thanks, as always, to Old Money Matthew Croak, web services by Ginger Power Limited, music by John Weber and GarageBand. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Tom Fay. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to Ellen Margolis, Chair of Theater and Dance at Pacific University in Oregon, and my co-star in our production there of A.R. Gurney's Love Letters last April. And finally, thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 549 1637ths of the Reduced Shakespeare Company.
The other thing I'm realizing about this is that, you know, we need to have these conversations before the great ones die. And so I'm grateful to you for talking to me about Pete now, but I think you and I need to schedule another conversation where you can tell me all about your friend Alan Ayckbourn.
Oh gosh, you know, if we did one on Alan, first of all, it would have to be in three parts, in three different locations, possibly, you know, interrelated conversations with different people, because talk about structurally complex.
This podcast is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to ReduceShakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.